If you wanted to learn about Bitcoin from the guy who has read more about it than anybody else you know, well, you've come to the right place. This is a Guy's Take episode. So I wanted to start the episode off just by saying how much fun I had chatting with Jason and Matt. I said it actually in the episode, but I really have been listening to their show for a really long time. It's really fun to see Jason come around to Bitcoin, because for the longest time, he really was not, he was very anti-Bitcoin, or saw it as just the speculative bubble. It was kind of tulip mania for him. It was just the new fad. But just being on the show, though, I think the most important thing it did for me, because I was kind of expecting the conversation to go in a different direction, and I forget when I'm so deep into Bitcoin, so like constantly, that I forget it. This reminds me of the perspective of an outsider looking into Bitcoin. I'm so deep in the weeds that I forget where the vast majority of people are starting at this from. And the truth is, 50 minutes is just not enough to cover a lot of the most fascinating things about Bitcoin and really what it means. So we got to hit some of the very basic things. But for instance, Jason talked about the user-friendliness problem, and I never really got to discuss, like I did get to kind of focus on the fact that your keys are your coins. You know, it's about the ownership of, you know, that passphrase and stuff that we talked about. But I never got to discuss the mountain of innovation occurring in that area of the market. We never got to talk about hardware wallets, physical Bitcoin notes, Bitcoin cards and Bitcoin like cash, like representations of like addresses and stuff, individual drives, things like OpenDime, even verifiable artwork, Bitcoin that are embedded into other things. It's just information in the end. So it's about protecting that information. And he talked about how frustrating it is to remember that key, and how scary, really, that it sounds. That, you know, you could lose this key, or somebody else could find this key, and I've essentially lost my coins. That's it. But keys are disappearing. Now, that is definitely this is a part of the transitional phase to understanding how best to use this technology. I don't think they will completely go away, but right now the main wallet that I use on my phone is entirely under my control. It has no seed phrase, and it's very secure. You got to remember, Bitcoin is programmable, and there are all kinds of encryption schemes. We've got so many developers working on making this more fluid. This is a programmable network and technology. It's going to evolve like the internet. So it's not a matter of finding one solution. It's the fact that there are going to be 1,000 solutions, and people will simply adopt the one that is best. But Bitcoin is the transaction and the data, the keys themselves are programmable. We already have services where I'm able to give another person or a service the ability to revive one of my lost keys. I can give them enough control that they can restore a key if I lost my phone or my passphrase or my hardware wallet or something else, but I am also not giving them the ability to spend my coins. It's a sort of backup service without actual custodianship. So I'm not giving them custody of my coins. So there's so many different aspects and like new technologies on this front that make user friendliness another, like, easily overcome, I think. Well, maybe not easily. It takes a lot of hard work from a ton of people, but it's not something that's insurmountable. And I don't think it will be one of those things that really make the difference between whether or not we are using Bitcoin or not. But even though there is so much awesome stuff to cover on that, that's not what this episode is about. So you'll have to subscribe, because I think I'm going to be doing that for the next Guy's Take episode coming next week. And we'll talk about all kinds of stuff in that way. then we kept talking and just talking about how, again, it was, you know, not user friendly, and how important those security practices are, how critical and unfamiliar they are. And we talked about how, you know, well, Jason mentioned how it would be really hard to see everybody using Bitcoin and doing business in it. And there was this basic presumption in his position, or maybe call it a perspective. I don't want it to seem like this is negative. It makes perfect sense from where he's coming from. But that we have to decide that we're going to use the app or the wallet service, and that it's just not going to make most sense for people because it's going to seem unfamiliar and awkward. But I think this herein lies a very important misunderstanding, or something that is just not being considered, is that soft money, money that is easily reproduced, that is unsecure, that is not scarce, fiat money being a prime example, has historically lived an incredibly short life in the presence of a harder money. And we've talked about this in shelling out the origins of money. There's a lot of great history there. You can listen to that episode. I will post that in the show notes. We just hit it as we went through the money section in Money, Bitcoin, and Time by Robert Breedlove, which we will be continuing through soon. I know it's taking me a bit to get back to it. We did the first three parts that were all the money sections. There's a lot of great history and talking about you know, when monies clash throughout history. So hard money and the competition between hard money and soft money, like West African societies, they didn't just choose to abandon agri beads or seashells or these similar monies that they've used all throughout the region. It was when those monies became easy to reproduce and they lost their unforgeable costliness. When it became abundant in the presence of a more scarce money, being gold or whatever the money of the foreigners were, whatever at the time. There are a lot of different options and a lot of different examples here. But it was never about what was easier to use or more user-friendly. It was what better served the role of money in society. And it was really irrelevant what you wanted to use. It was what best accomplished that goal. Wampum, there's so many examples of this. Rhizestones, the necklaces of the Kula trade networks. That's another one that's in a lot in The Origins of Money by Nick Szabo. These things died because better technology came along. They lost their monetary attributes, and a harder money outcompeted them in the market. So Bitcoin, it's not just like we got to make this thing so user-friendly that our grandma can use it so everybody will use the same app. It's she'll end up using Bitcoin because the dollars in her bank account will only maintain their value because the bank is holding Bitcoin to back it. It's like same as she never made the switch from the analog phone network to packet switching. She never adopted the internet. The telephone system was simply disrupted. They moved from the telecommunication, like the switching, the analog switching network to a digital packet switching over the internet network out from underneath her, you know, manila yellow corded phone that hung in her kitchen. And because of that, I think Bitcoin is inevitable. That's why it's so crucial that we learn it now so that we can actually be a part of the wave of growth that, you know, grandma has no idea happened. And even though she doesn't think she uses the internet every day, but she does. Just because she has a regular TV service and she has the same analog phone service, neither one of those things run on the same infrastructure she thought they did. They're only analog just before it gets to her house. So that's also not what this episode is about. So today's episode, that's going to be another Guys Take episode. So you'll have to subscribe and stick around for that one. But today's episode, I have put together my own personal list of how I differentiate the major disruptions of the internet. I've read a lot of books about the history of the internet, the protocol wars that happened at the beginning of the internet, the huge number of industries and technology. Like, I've always followed this stuff forever. This kind of thing fascinates me, how the internet disrupts these incumbent industries, and how seemingly minor changes in technologies and in these protocols have astounding effects and birth entirely new industries. It's one of my favorite topics to talk about and read about and think about. So I've put together my list of these major disruptions as I see them, about how the internet encroached on these other industries and services, use cases, or innovated in accomplishing some task in a completely novel or more efficient way. Because I think Bitcoin is the beginning. It's kind of like stage one. It's the nail in the coffin that really sets off the movement of the seventh stage of digital disruption that we are going through. I think there have been six core organization and technological disruptions that the internet has incited or been the foundation for so far. And I think Bitcoin is starting another wave. And I think this wave could be far larger than any of the ones that have come before it. And I don't think that's a stretch. That is what this episode is about. We're talking about Bitcoin and the seventh great disruption of the digital age. Welcome to the Crypto Economy with Guy Swan. Thank you guys for joining me. We are going to be talking all about, we're going to be learning all about the early internet. And I want to paint that overarching picture. I want to paint that bird's eye view. No, I want to paint the moon's eye view of what is happening with the internet, and what major disruptions have come before it, and what part Bitcoin is playing in this whole thing. Because I think when you start to see those major pieces to the puzzle, you realize just how big of a shift Bitcoin is going to be. It's not just an app. It's not just some fun little token. It's not just blockchain. It is a relatively minor fundamental shift in how we organize and come to agreement with each other that is going to have astronomical effects as it extrapolates out, as we start building layers on top of this and it integrates with all the other technology that we already have and all of these other systems that we already have. I think having a foundation of decentralized money is going to decentralize a lot of what it's going to re-decentralize a lot of what the internet has already disrupted. So I think we're going to see these other six stages of the internet disruption that we have seen so far. I think we're going to see a massive wave of new decentralization going back down the ladder of these disruptions because of what Bitcoin is enabling. And I'll defend that here as we get into this. So, welcome to the show. I'm Guy Swan. I am the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And today we're going to talk about my favorite topic ever, how the internet is changing the world, has changed the world, and the role that Bitcoin is playing and will continue to play in that change. So if Bitcoin is the seventh stage of disruption here, or the seventh great disruption that is happening with the internet, what are the other six? I think, kind of just break down in a bullet point list, we have mail and general communication. We have publishing. Then we have the communications infrastructure, which I think is important to separate that out. Then we have e-commerce. And then we have general media, music and movies. And then one that I think gets lumped in, and I think the source or the beginnings of this one is not properly understood. I think it started much earlier. I think it was one of the earliest parts of the internet, was the crowdsourcing phenomenon, the collaboration phenomenon. And then last will be Bitcoin, will be the disruption of finance and the very nature of networks of value. So let's head back to the beginning and start with just email and general communication. And that really was the beginnings of the internet. It was when we figured out how to do general communication with, like I didn't have to put a letter in a mailbox and put a stamp on it to communicate with someone else who had joined this network. In the early ARPANET and the other general alternatives and stuff that were all typically, like, the vast majority of what was going on was part of ARPANET, where you had, like, these licensed contractors who could be on the actual networks. And it was largely academic networks at the time. It was a, you know, facility at UCLA. It was the Stanford Research Institution. There was, I think, like four or five of the very beginning nodes on the network were all just universities sharing and collaborating. And the original use case, the original killer app outside of general communication was the ability to, for originally they were thought that this was going to be able to be used to share resources, that we were going to log in and I was going to use somebody else's computer to accomplish a task. But the real value and the real application that came about from these early networks was simply logging into another computer and sharing a file, which is fascinating that, like, you know, this is basically true to this day. We haven't really changed what we do with the internet. We're all just logging into some other computer and looking at their files. And this was, these early days, like, this was very late 60s, early 70s. This is when Telnet and FTP were developed, well before TCP/IP in the later 70s. Like Telnet, you can open it up today. Like, fun, if you want to play around with it, you can open up your terminal and you can type in Telnet, and it's probably just sitting and ready and waiting for you. If you want to, like, do a little digging and you want to, you know, play around, you can do man, M-A-N, that's short for manual, and then space, Telnet, T-E-L-N-E-T. You can just read about it. They have manual pages in there. These too long didn't read, which probably you'd have to install. But these early protocols, these early things developed, are still there. It's just sitting on your computer waiting to be used. You shouldn't. They're really insecure. You can use FTP, particularly on, like, a local network, but you should not be using Telnet to communicate out on on the internet or try to connect to another computer that is not in your house. But this was the original use, is these research facilities or whatever were sharing files and letting other people log into their computers and explore. Like, they could share documents, you know, research, data, all this kind of stuff. And it wasn't until, this is when it really changed collaboration earlier and the sharing of research between these institutions that were experimenting with the network. And it was kind of an initial use case of, like, proving that, like, wow, okay, this could be an incredibly useful technology. We really need to develop it. So this was the discovery and experimentation phase of the protocol. And like I said earlier, the concept of the internet, of these interconnected networks, of connecting all these things together as one, wasn't born really until 1975. And this is what led to the creation of TCP/IP. That's the underlying protocol of the internet, telecommunications protocol, internet protocol. And it's what, you know, you have that number, like, if you ever logged into your router, it's like 192.168.0.1, whatever. That is an IP address. That is essentially your local version of that same protocol that the entire internet works on top of. And this led to a few different implementations of this protocol. There's really fascinating history. There are actually two books on the Bitcoin Survivors book list that I think are really good. Well, maybe actually three, I think about it. That are really good for just kind of exploring these early days, How the Internet Happened. There's the third one that I was thinking probably should be added is Exploding the Phone, and about the history of AT&T and the first hackers, and the phone networks, just because I think that was so critical to understanding the difference, like what happened when the internet was born, like what that key communications difference was with the AT&T network versus the packet switching. And then also, this machine kills secrets, which is another fascinating, more of the like cypherpunk and activist history and stuff, but also very important to understanding how this technology changes things and how it changes social and power dynamics among society. So really fun stuff to dig into there if you want to go a little bit deeper. But like there were multiple different implementations of the internet protocol. They actually tried it over satellites. There's one called Aloha, I think. Yeah, Aloha that I think that one was one of the ones that was they attempted to do over radio channels, like straight up radio stations, but you couldn't have multiple parties communicating at the same time. And then of course Ethernet came about around that same time. This was over coaxial at the time, but Ethernet was actually developed by a team at Xerox, and it was led by Robert Metcalfe. So if you know Metcalfe's law about the value of a network as the square of its users, yeah, this is the same guy. And this is the period when operating systems began to implement these at the system level that network connections, like, I mean, you would buy a PC or you would buy a computer device and there would be no networking. Like, it wasn't, that's not what the early machines were about. So you had to actually implement these things. You forget how many steps there are involved in just even having a computer or a device that's internet ready from the manufacturer. That these standards had to be adopted in such a way where it made sense. Like, there had to be one to connect to. You couldn't implement 100 different versions of this thing all into the same device. It'd be ridiculous. And the correlation here that we're actually seeing in the Bitcoin space, as we see these built-in compatibility with the standards in the industry or the new technology, is that we have these. Samsung is releasing a phone now that's going to have a dedicated chip to deal with the generation, the signing, the verification of cryptographic keys. Dealing with Bitcoin, I think Ethereum and a bunch of other things, they all use very similar stuff, so it's not hard to make a general purpose chip for those sorts of tasks. Then we've got ASICs and the dedicated hardware for mining. And of course, now we've got, there's this huge norm that has kind of grown up in the last 10 years of dedicated security chips inside devices, of separating the actual hardware of the security of the keys, because we're doing so much more business and there's so much more important information on the internet. I think this trend will continue, and I think this trend is going to be accelerated in a massive way when it comes to Bitcoin, because Bitcoin changes that security dynamic. It changes exactly what the consequences of bad security are, and it doesn't have any fail safes. You have to have an isolated environment in which you are working from, or you don't have security in any other way. So, but very early on, that's when we started having dedicated hardware, dedicated software, operating system level integration of the internet. And this was also when we started to branch into, we started building all the Lego pieces for the third major disruption of the internet, was the infrastructure inversion, because this is where the, I already talked about operating systems, but the NSFnet, I believe, I'm not mistaken, was the first one to, where they built dedicated routers, where you would actually have, I mean, one of them had like a really funny name, one of the first ones. It was called like Fuzzball or something, but it was a dedicated machine. It was a router, very similar, at least in job, to the router that you would install from, you know, Asus or Netgear or whatever in your house for the internet. It was dedicated machinery to store and forward all of these packets that were happening on the internet. And this is when DNS servers came about, where DNS, for those of you who don't know, that's the domain name service, or domain name servers, is that, like when you're connecting to Google, you're connecting to an IP address. You're just connecting, just like those very early networks, you're just logging into someone else's computer and looking at a file. It happens to be a website file. But you don't have to memorize the exact path location of that file. You know, I mean, think about like a path on a computer, like how many folders and subfolders you have to deal with to get to something. A DNS is like a global shortcut system. So how can we get to this as quickly as possible? Rather than having to go to find out which exact IP address is Google's or which ones I can connect to, and then go looking for the specific file for the specific website, the DNS server just gives you a www.google.com, and that takes you right to right where you need to go every single time. But that is a domain name service. It became a shortcut system to make the internet more user friendly, to simplify what was a very complicated and unfamiliar process. But it's really important to remember what the internet enabled, what it did in comparison to its alternative communication networks. Is it because it was a decentralized communication protocol where it was an open access network? When you were connecting to AT&T or an analog phone system, when you were connecting to any of these networks, telegraph, etc., before, the network was quote unquote smart in a sense that all the features of the network were built into the network. And you were just a user that could make use of that network. You could just, you know, you would call AT&T and get yourself a connection and a phone, and then you would have permission to use the network. The internet flipped this situation on its head. The internet was a decentralized, open access network where people moved the applications from the center of the network. Like, if you wanted to do something clever with the phone system, if you wanted to create voicemail in the age of the AT&T network, you had to call AT&T, and AT&T had to implement it on their back-end infrastructure for voicemail to become a thing if you were talking about it in like a network sense. But in the internet was permissionless. It was the exact opposite. Since everybody could just log into anyone's computer, well, all the security was brought to the individual level on all the computers that are at the edges. The innovation went to the edges and the applications went to the edges. So now you have this open access network where anyone can contribute. AT&T doesn't have to create all the innovation. Now literally anyone can just connect to this network and provide any innovation they want. They could create a voicemail service on some website and then just house two users. It doesn't matter. You can try it on one person. You can scale up and connect to the entire world. You can have a billion users. But the access is no different between the two. It is all one open access system, and you don't need anyone's permission to create these applications. You just join the network, and it's like an open community square on a global level where anyone can connect to anyone. And what this really meant was that anyone in the world, rather than having a dedicated set of engineers and creators who had to come up with all the interesting ideas for the AT&T network and all the interesting services, well, now anyone in the world could be those people. A 14-year-old kid in his garage could completely upend the internet. It could completely create a service that changed millions and millions of people's lives, which we saw happen a bunch of times throughout the history of the internet. Now everyone in the world could be an engineer. Now everyone in the world could be an innovator and a creator. And that key ability to connect to other users, to other computers on the internet that birthed this was all again during the, created the client-server computing. This created the network-connected file systems and network-accessible servers and all of this stuff. During this age and this fundamental difference that the internet provided, this was the first explosion of the growth phase of the initial growth phase of the internet. And it got hundreds of companies and institutions involved in expanding on and collaborating in order to continue the development of this thing. And it was ultimately what led to the second major disruption phase of the internet, which was publishing. Now, a lot of people, I'm not just talking about Amazon selling books online. I'm not talking about iBooks. I'm not talking about eBooks. That is all a huge continuation of that. I am talking about the birth of the web. And this happened in the mid-1990s, right around 1995. And the critical part of the web, what made the web different, was in establishing a common format for just labeling and identifying documents on the web. And it established the standards for the DNS, the domain file path, so that everyone was communicating in the exact same way. And it was really standardized by the birth of HTML and HTTP. And the web was what changed how we saw and interacted with information. That was the beginning of newspapers becoming irrelevant. And HTTP, the hypertext transport protocol, it's what enables linking on the internet. It's what makes it so that you can just put a word and click on that word and it takes you to the next thing or the image, et cetera, et cetera. Created a living internet. You're not just looking at a file. HTTP and the systems that organize websites are what made the internet navigable. Like people don't realize, I think it's completely discounted, and I think of the killer app of the internet is not really the web, but it's the web is what enabled it. But the killer app of the internet was surfing. It was the ability to travel through the information that you were looking at. It was the ability to get lost down a rabbit hole of other things, and the ability to just click on something and then boom, you're on that piece of information. You could surf. It was a crazy different way. It was a fundamentally different way to consume information. Everything else before was completely curated. You weren't traveling through it. It was holding your hand and telling you exactly where to go. You didn't decide what was on the next page of the newspaper when you read it. You could not decide what the next show would come on TV or when you watched your favorite show. It came on at a particular time, and you either caught that show or you missed it. And the internet began to change that. Obviously, there was no media like in the 1990s. Like, you barely would get a good picture of something on the internet, and it would take days to download it, and you'd watch it, like, load from the top down. Anybody who experienced the internet on a 56K modem knows exactly what I'm talking about. Or you just wait for it to show up slowly, line by line. You're like, oh, there is a picture under there. Oh, my God, look at the background. That background is so cool. Oh, my God. You just sit there and wait. But this was the age of the birth of the browser, the ability to view the internet as a thing, to look at documents specifically in the format of the web and to traverse them in a completely unique way. And this also led to, so not only was this about like magazines and newspapers very early on, but just kind of news in general, because you could get quick snippets of it. The ability to access information this way began to change very quickly how people thought of information and documents. And that was really the second major disruption. And it continues to this day. Amazon selling books online and becoming the greatest, you know, distributor of books, Apple iBooks and Kindle eBooks, all of these things. Now people are reading books electronic. People are storing and have electronic libraries of things. And then of course, encyclopedias, Wikipedia is a very old, thing. And again, that's part of disruption number six that I will get to in a moment, which is one of my favorite because I think it's an overarching piece of this whole thing. But that was publishing, and it was really the web that started that whole change. It's the idea of the web is a giant open, permissionless, global publishing platform. That was disruption number two. Then three is really the communications infrastructure inversion, is that everything became, all communication networks became the internet. Everything we had before, analog phone, radio, satellite, coaxial television, all of these things slowly just became extensions of the digital. It was just, radio became the last mile to get the media to the customer. A satellite became the last mile. It all became digital internet infrastructure. And this happened really invisibly. People didn't see, this was, AT&T had a veritable monopoly for numerous decades. That one's hacking Ma Bell, or no, excuse me, exploding the phone about hacking Ma Bell, about hacking the AT&T phone network. Such a fascinating book. You gotta read that one. That one is all about the veritable monopoly of AT&T and how they managed, partly how they managed to maintain that monopoly, even though it was really about the phone freaks of the early days and the first network, the first national and really global network to hack into and play, which was just so much fun, so many fun stories around that era. But this is what broke AT&T apart. Yeah, there were a couple of antitrust things, but it was really the shift in technology that made anyone able to communicate or participate in this infrastructure, and it decentralized the technology, and AT&T was not able to maintain a monopoly in the completely new technological space. The playing field changed very drastically because anybody could offer up services and applications at the edge. Again, it pushed innovation from the center and from the businesses out to the edge of the network where it was permissionless and anyone could participate. So because of that, the infrastructure layer of our global communications slowly all became, they everything just got flipped upside down and it all became the internet. The internet really became our underlying network that connects all of these other segmented networks. Every network that you connect to in one way or the other goes back to the internet. It's like how all tributaries and rivers and creeks and streams go back to the ocean. The internet is the ocean, and everything else is just, you know, your favorite port or your favorite avenue in order to reach it, I guess you could say. All right, I need a quick break, and then I want to grab something to drink. We'll hit our sponsor, and we'll get into e-commerce and how the internet literally began to disrupt physical stores and just the idea of exchange and commerce. Now, e-commerce was another major phase of disruption for the internet. And the first, the guys who actually programmed the ability to charge a credit card or debit card online, the original code was written by, there's a movie about it called Middlemen, and it was done so that they could take a charge online to share people pictures of pornography. They're basically just charging for porn online. Of course, porn is the thing that pioneers the entire development, and but that movie is actually hilarious. If you haven't seen it, it's a really fun movie. It's got Luke Wilson in it, and who's the other actor? I can't remember. I don't know. I can't remember the other actors' names, but really fun movie if you haven't seen it. The first e-commerce purchase, supposedly, like the first like good sold online, if you actually look it up, they say is a Sting CD, but I don't exactly know how that relates to the whole explosion of porn online, because I imagine they wouldn't want it to be famous that somebody bought a picture of a naked lady as the first thing on the internet. But Amazon really pioneered, like really hit this off. eBay was another major player, but these things truly shook entire like incumbent industries here. I mean, If you grew up, you knew Radio Shack, Circuit City. There were a lot of huge businesses that just up and vanished. Because the internet, the big key as far as the internet goes that they made available was the amount of selection. Before the internet, it used to be that, you know, if someone didn't have a store that sold incredibly niche items in your, you know, geographic area, in your local area, then you couldn't get it. Which makes a great reason why something like Circuit City and Radio Shack, like those sorts of stores, were ones that went out of business relatively quickly during this transitional phase, because the breadth of things in electronics, and that's why Best Buy is suffering, and that's when you go into a Best Buy store, they got a heck of a lot of floor space dedicated to washing machines and appliances now. It's because they're losing the game, because there's only so much that you can fit in a store, and the overhead of having a place where people, like having a huge on display, like products out everywhere, and available for people to like kind of look through, the overhead of doing that is massive. It's very expensive floor space. And more importantly, the real estate is always in a very high-end area. It's not some warehouse way out in the middle of nowhere that costs a 20th of the rental price per foot. It's in the middle of a huge shopping center or in the mall or something like that. So the overhead for those sorts of things was massive, and e-commerce just really wiped the floor with a lot of edge case markets that got served in, you know, 10 or 100 times better in the online world when you could connect more people. That was one of those things that the internet was so incredibly powerful with, is niche markets. Connecting, you know, if 100 people anywhere in the world have the same weird hobby or something, they can make a community and they can get together and they can find each other. And that's incredibly powerful. It enables communities and products and markets that simply could not exist if you had to have a local store. I mean, if you're talking about a niche that has like 100 people, and let's say it's two people in each state, how could you ever have a physical store that supplied that need? But if you could sell something regularly to those 100 people, you could have a business. So it's a really powerful thing about the internet, in the fact that it distributed that communication. So you're no longer limited to the geographic area for what you can sell. And then you can have some store like freaking Amazon online that sells practically anything. Like, their index of stuff that you can purchase on that website looks like the index for the internet. I mean, it's just an endless thing. I mean, I buy car parts off of there. And there's so much stuff up there. It's crazy. So that and eBay, there were so many big names that like went through that that disruption period. And we're seeing it continue. Like, now there's this huge explosion in subscription services, which I love. My wife loves those things too. We have like ButcherBox. In fact, I've thought about reaching out to them to do a sponsorship of the show. I had no idea if they would. But that weird marriage of carnivore and Bitcoin maximalism, I think, is actually a really good fit. But ButcherBox, like, we ship, get meat, grass-fed, really high-quality meat, frozen, sent straight to the door every month. That's incredibly helpful. That simplifies and automates a lot of general consumption stuff. We have that toothbrush thing, which I could do without because it's a little bit overpriced, but my wife likes it, and the toothbrushes look really pretty sitting up on the counter, so I'll let that one slide. And we do like a paleo bakehouse thing too. Just so many interesting services that the subscription service model is a huge thing that is exploding. I hope it continues to grow, because the amount of time saved in simplifying and automating something that you have to do over and over and over again, it doesn't make sense that we have to waste all this time on it. And I love that. So that's another huge part of the continuation of the e-commerce disruption, where the internet is just consuming all of this, that you're not going to go to a store, you're not even going to go to a physical store for some of your regular items, like toothpaste and razors. What is it? Harry's razors or whatever. Hear them advertised all the time on other podcasts. So obviously, e-commerce, huge, huge disruption of the internet. And what's funny is one of the major pieces of that puzzle was yet again another protocol innovation. It was SSL. It was the ability to have an encrypted connection and send credit card details over the internet through, you know, 9 other servers before it got to the destination of whoever was charging your account and them not being able to see it. Now, I remember, like, it was really scary. I remember when it was becoming a thing that you would punch in your credit card online and everybody talked about how it was the worst thing ever and you should never do it. But obviously, everybody just became comfortable with it. But at first, like, it seemed really scary and it seemed really stupid. And it probably was pretty stupid early on, depending on exactly how secure your connection and stuff was. But it was really the encrypted connection. It was SSL that made the difference in whether or not that could actually be sustained, whether the fallout or the consequences of attempting to do that online could actually be mitigated or not. Because there would never be, if you were just open broadcasting this stuff, then no, it would all fall apart in a matter of days. But this leads us to number 5, the 5th major disruption of the internet: music, movies, and media. And there are many stages inside of this process as well. It really started with music, and honestly, the big shift was with physical media players. It was the MP3 player, and more specifically, the iPod, that had a massive market and consumer-driven shift in the entire ecosystem. Because as soon as you move to the iPod, as soon as your media that you're playing in your physical life is no longer on a CD, and you don't no longer have to get an anti-skip CD player so you can walk around with headphones on, but instead you're already consuming it at the end on the consumer side as an MP3. It then changes the market to how you get your media. Because you have to have the end road of the consumer adopt a new the new medium with which you're going to consume the media with. So, like, for instance, like if you're buying a CD, it becomes a really complicated conversion process to then rip it onto your computer and then put it in your MP3 player. But if you've already got an MP3 player, it doesn't make any sense. You now don't really want the CD. You want to just buy the MP3. So that was kind of an inversion in the market when the most convenient hardware, you could hold thousands of songs in a single iPod as opposed to a disc that held 12 maybe, you know, if you're lucky. But aside from the convenience, there was already something at play that made it push in that direction already, that made the need to solve that problem, to shift how we were listening to music, critical. And it was file sharing. It was Napster. Napster came out, like, was invented in like 98 or 99. I can't remember the exact date. And then you had like Nutella and eDonkey over the next couple of years. Peer-to-peer music sharing exploded online, and I remember being a part of it back then. Yes, I illegally downloaded music when I was like 10 years old or wherever, however hell old I was. And looking back on it now, it's actually shocking to see how quick it actually all changed, that file sharing wasn't a thing, and then suddenly, like, you know, I've got Winamp Media Player and Rhapsody, the streaming service, came out, and Napster was there. It was like all these things happened like right back to back. It was literally like a 2 to 3 year transition before MP3s were the dominant format for music. It was an incredible incredibly fast explosion, and it was a response to file sharing because MP3s were such a compressed, easy-to-share online format that became popular, and essentially the market had to rush to catch up and to figure out how to capitalize on something that was stealing market. And obviously that came with a lot of lawsuits, it came with down the shutting down of Napster, and a ton of innovation and shifting in these decentralized like file sharing systems rather than or creating decentralized ones as opposed to centralized ones. And that's when, you know, as a handful of years in development, and that caused BitTorrent was essentially the result, and it has essentially remained dominant ever since. But that was the beginning of the death of physical media. And now we've got, obviously, streaming services. And just like the web changed how we viewed just general information and news and stuff, streaming is doing that same thing with media. Netflix and all this stuff that has exploded in the last couple of years. I mean, Netflix was very small as far as like internet traffic. I was actually working at Spectrum. I was actually working as an internet technician at the time that the shift to Netflix being the dominant mover of information on the internet was a thing. I mean, it happened in almost no time. It was crazy to see it go from just this tiny percentage of the internet to like, yeah, 60% of our traffic is just a bunch of people getting a full freaking HD stream from Netflix. And the whole company has to adjust. The whole infrastructure has to immediately adjust because now they've got, they're feeding 20, 30 times as the amount of data to every customer's home. And it's simultaneously, like I said, changing how people consume the information, how people consume the media. You no longer have to wait for the next episode to come out in 2 weeks. You can binge watch the whole series like it's a movie. You watch 13 episodes back to back, like, you know, and just deck out your coffee table and a bunch of snacks and stuff and just go to town. And because of that, people have control over what time they watch the show, when they watch the show, how much of each show they watch, et cetera, et cetera. It creates another, it again changes how people interact with it. And what's funny is it was really the birth of these file formats was really the beginning of this happening. When you had a compact way to move good quality media quickly between users, and there's no market demand actually filling that, users will, if there is a technological way to get the media that they wanted. It's funny, piracy has come down a lot. BitTorrent is actually in decline right now because the media is now so accessible, there's not a huge need for it anymore. Before, it was getting around this giant barrier in the market where the users wanted the market to change to respond to how they were interacting with these new systems and this new technology and all this incredible convenience. But they refused. They wanted to charge the price and therefore the profit margin that they get with having to print onto a physical media, put it in a truck, box it up, ship it, decorate it, send it out, and then put it in stores and have it sit there waiting for customers for weeks on end. They wanted that to stay the price. But in the digital age, you could just publish it somewhere online and millions of people could replicate it for you. That cost was gone. And because of that, that's why file sharing exploded, because they weren't charging the new market price in response to the technology. They weren't utilizing the most efficient technology in order to get it to the customer, and they weren't adopting the new platform because it required they fire a lot of people and change their business model. It was a huge, painful shift. That's why it came with a lot of, you know, jail time and suing people. It was rough. But there is another aspect of media that I think is usually not thought of, but I consider it part of the same transition, was advertising. How Google completely changed how you would get someone's attention. And I think that was just because as the media moved into a new space And as the web and surfing became its own thing, its own way of consuming information and media, what we needed an entirely new way to reach out to people and to pinpoint, to find exactly who your audience was. And an interesting element to this was that because people were now interacting with their information and were now surfing on the web, there was so much additional specific information. You could now isolate audiences like that one business that has 100 people who are interested in that one good, you know, all around the world, or that one product. Now you had to be able to pinpoint and figure out who those 100 people were so that you could reach out to them and let them know that your product exists, that your community exists. It's funny, I watched a documentary. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was somebody from either Amazon or Google, and they were talking about the, I think it was in reference to like the Amazon Go store, like that new store where like you can just walk in, pick up items off the shelves and walk out, and it just charges you. It knows what you picked up. And he was talking about the incredible amount of information that you can get from it, and all the brilliant things that you could do. He's just fascinated with the data. It's like mining all of that data. It's like you can figure out where people were in the store, how long they looked at a product, which shelf they stopped at, what they saw or picked up first off the shelf, when they actually lingered next to a product, or when they just skipped over stuff. And it was funny, but he was like, I'm torn between the incredibly, like the insane things that I could do. I just want to see all this information. I want to play with it. But then at the same time, I'm like, oh my God, it's so awful that we have all of this data. And like, what a huge invasion of privacy this is. So it was just hilarious to kind of have him talk about like the dichotomy between like, oh, this is so exciting to have all this data. Oh, holy crap, it's awful. How do we have all of this data? So, and that's one of those aspects where I think Bitcoin is so important as the seventh major disruption, is that we have to build privacy and security back into the foundation of this thing. And I think one of those, something like advertising and Google, is going to be one of the parts of the incumbent internet that gets re-disrupted as Bitcoin takes us into a new phase of this whole thing. All right, and now the sixth disruption, which is a little bit in part all of these things, but I think it's a critical distinction because it's manifested itself in so many different ways, is the crowdsourcing. It's the sharing economy, and not just file sharing, but like the collaboration economy. This is what birthed open source. This is what birthed Wikipedia. This is what birthed Uber and Lyft and ride sharing services. This is what birthed crowdfunding. This birthed so many different companies. Open source is an entirely different, like, business model. It completely takes the middle managers out of the equation, and it puts engineers directly in contact with the community that is using this software or program or something. It completely changes the idea of an organization, one that is fluid and where anyone can participate, and anyone who has any stake, they can solve their own problems in a collaborative way with the community. The open source movement is actually massive. People don't realize that the entire internet runs on open source software. It has completely changed what it means in the internet age to be successful. I think a lot of people miss just how critical that transition was. In fact, you should listen to a piece I did called, I read by Chris Dannon and I can't remember the other authors, but it's by Iterative Capital, and it's good. The Iterative Capital Thesis: What's Really Driving the Cryptocurrency Phenomenon? And it talks all about the contest between engineers and managers throughout the years, and it goes all the way back to unions and stuff. It hits stuff through the 40s, 50s, and 60s, leading up to, like kind of showing the pressures and the fundamental stressors that led to this huge shift and led to the engineers essentially the incentives, how the incentives were misaligned so that the middle managers and the owners and like the board of these companies would want to own or want to add arbitrary features and things because they wanted it to look good. It was that marketing hype. They had to look like a product that was busy, whereas the engineers and the consumers and stuff, that they're looking to solve a problem, and you get all this technical debt when you're in the corporate model, and how the incentives are misaligned. They're aligned in order to kind of make it look like people are busy and people are doing things, and you want to have flashy changes. You want to have changes that the consumer can see, whereas in the open source and the engineer specific, you just want to solve problems as far as like what the engineers and what the consumers are want. You want to solve one specific problem really, really well and really reliably. And that's where the whole the worse is better philosophy came about. The whole get out a minimum viable product, solve one problem or two problems really well, and then get a community around it and start building on top of it and crowdsource your entire company, crowdsource your entire software. And it really had a huge effect. And there are so many different things using the crowd, using the fact that we're all now connected. You can reach out and have anybody be a taxi with Uber. You can crowdfund some project. You can crowdfund a charity for, you know, terrible events and stuff. You crowdsource information with Wikipedia. It's a fascinating story on Wikipedia. I can't remember exactly what era this was, but it was while Encyclopedia Britannica was still around, and I remember reading about it at the time. So Encyclopedia Britannica sells huge printed books. They can't change anything. They have to have, they hire hundreds, thousands of employees to fact check all of this crap, and when new things happen, they can't update it, you know? Like, it's just, you buy the books, and if it stops in 1999, well, something that happened in 2000 or 2001 isn't in your book. And you have to buy this whole set of encyclopedias all over again in a couple of years. So, the model clearly was not ready for the information age. And now Wikipedia seems like an absolute insanity. Seems like the stupidest idea ever. Anybody can edit it? Are you kidding me? Everybody said it wasn't going to work. Encyclopedia Britannica people railed against it. But Wikipedia was quickly becoming a crucial source. I mean, I remember they wouldn't let you use Wikipedia as a source when I was doing like papers, but everybody just used Wikipedia. Like, obviously, it's the easiest way to get to all the information. So what you would do is you just go down to the sources on Wikipedia, and you go straight to the sources and you use them as your source. But everybody still used Wikipedia to do the project or the paper or whatever it was, because it was such a massive resource. There was nothing that could compare. Flipping through an encyclopedia was a joke in comparison. But there was some sort of a study done where they tried to find inaccuracies on Wikipedia in a subsection of Wikipedia and then a subsection of Encyclopedia Britannica. And they found that it was actually very close. It was something like Encyclopedia Britannica had like four errors for every whatever subset of data that they assessed. And then Wikipedia had like seven errors for the same like density of information. And what was funny is because it was close enough, Encyclopedia Britannica, the only thing they could do was denounce the study because of the dichotomy between the two information formats. Encyclopedia Britannica now had to admit that, you know, four errors out of this amount of space was, they couldn't do anything about. They just had false information in there. They would have had to reprint all the books in order to do it. And now Wikipedia looks like, looks comparable in reliability, and is vastly more efficient, is vastly more convenient for the people to use. And so they railed against this study. They're like, no, this is nonsense. Wikipedia can never work, blah, blah, blah. And then the Wikipedia guys are like, that's great. That's fantastic news. You found all these errors? Send them to us. We'll update them tomorrow. And that's essentially what happened, is because of the crowdsourcing of the data type of the format, they were able to correct all the errors that this study had found. And it was not very long after that that it just, the fight was basically over and encyclopedias were a thing of the past. They got buried in the coffin with all the other major disruption events that happened across the internet. And I think really the crowdsourcing, the protocol development, this started at the very beginning. This is one of the things that the internet just enabled as soon as there was a network, is that people could collaborate. I mean, it was about computer science and academic research, connecting people to freely work together and collaborate on all of this stuff. And that has not only has that not ceased, it has accelerated and taken on a bunch of new forms with Airbnb and Uber and these other forms of crowdsourcing your product, your supply, your capital goods, your production. And I think we're going to see the same thing with something like 3D printing, where as 3D printing actually becomes more ubiquitous and lower funded, it makes a whole lot of sense that people can just bid. You know, if I just need a little plastic tool that works this certain way or has this certain shape and, you know, quality or whatever, that I can just find one of any 100 or 200 people with 3D printers or laser cutters or whatever, and any one of them with a decent reputation can fulfill my order. So I think there's plenty of movement to happen in this exact same thing, and especially with the open source hardware movement taking on, which I think another Bitcoin is another key part of. There's so much expansive area left for number six to continue essentially disrupting. But all of this leads to number seven: Bitcoin and the disruption of finance. I think in 10 years, we have seen the equivalent of the development of maybe around 20 years of the internet, from the early 1970s to the early mid-1990s. And where Bitcoin right now has the most disruption, where it will make the most difference, is during this currency war as a safe haven, as a savings vehicle, particularly during its monetization phase, because its growth will be so potent, be so in just utterly massive, that it will create a global safe haven and a completely global permissionless, just like the internet. All the innovation happens at the edges. Anybody can build a new app or a new program or a new protocol for Bitcoin, just the way anybody could innovate on the internet. Any new website can create an entirely different service and completely change how we interact with and think about using the Bitcoin system. And that's where we have things like Lightning Network and state chains and all of this crazy technology that's going on. Bitcoin is the internet of money, as Andreas Antonopoulos essentially refers to it. Is that it is a programmable, just like TCP/IP was a packet switching system for data, for little packets of data. It was how to forward, store, and secure and order, and make sure everything's lined up exactly how it's supposed to go in transmitting large amounts of information. Bitcoin is that for obtaining the scarcity, the independence, and the storage and transport of value. And because of that, we can build all sorts of very basic fundamental layer of the internet, which is going to have incredible disruptive potential. Incredible disruptive potential. And the industries that are going to be hit the biggest are the ones that are closely tied to the current financial weaknesses and attack vectors, the debt imbalances, the subsidy culture, and the bureaucracy, the political connections, all of the major markets that exploit those weaknesses in how money is created, who receive that money first, are going to be most disrupted by Bitcoin. And that starts with governance and government in general, central banks, because they are the actual issuers of that debt. It's going to hit the judicial and legal markets, because you can write contracts in this that are extrajudicial, that do not matter. Imagine having a business contract that no matter what judge you go to, no matter what jurisdiction you're in, no matter what side of which border you are in anywhere in the world, it always executes exactly the same way. And you don't have to worry about corruption. You don't have to worry about cartels buying somebody off. You don't have to worry about a judge who's socialist versus a judge who's conservative versus a judge who's liberal versus whatever. You don't have to care about any of that. Your business contract executes on Bitcoin. End of story. What is that worth? What is that worth when the economy becomes global? We're going to see huge disruption in real estate because it's become such a massive safe haven asset, because money has sucks at its job right now. Money does nothing but lose value. It's a poisonous, like, it's like a sieve. It's just leaking value like crazy. And all currencies are doing it. Even the dollar may gain value versus one of those others, but look at the price of everything. Prices of everything goes up. The dollar's leaking. It's just not quite as fast as all the other ones are leaking. Education, healthcare, massively subsidized, massively debt-fueled industries. Going to have a huge, huge shift in those industries because of Bitcoin. Anything that is enormously financially imbalanced and requires, that is being fueled by new money, that is being fueled by political privilege and political connection, that is being fueled by subsidy, all of those things are going to have the rug pulled out from underneath them, because Bitcoin will make finance tight again. It will make all the accounting tricks that explode and bloat all of these markets impossible to do within the Bitcoin economy. So as things start to move, as Bitcoin starts to suck up these markets, which, by the way, we're already starting to see just the general internet, just the communication side of things undermine these systems. But because the subsidy and the monetary side of it is still so bloated, they're not able to take the real pool. Like education, massively undermined. You can get a nearly free, dirt cheap, incredible education online with hundreds of online alternatives. I would never have gone back to school to learn Linux and a lot of the internet protocols and the stuff that I've learned, like the Cisco and the networking shit. It makes no sense. I can spend $200 and get an incredible online course where somebody is walking me through it on video, where I can ask people questions. I can join a forum with everybody working on the same projects and collaborate with other people. It's unbelievable. It is 100 times better than the unbelievably overcost and bloated university system. I would never, ever go back. I look at my university education as one of the worst investments of my life, from a dollar-for-dollar standpoint, from what I learned to how much it cost me. There's no comparison. Healthcare the same way. If it wasn't for the subsidies, if it wasn't for being able to just shove high school kids just straight into that college box, like without them knowing, I didn't know what it meant to go $20,000, $40,000 into debt for a college education. I didn't have the slightest clue. It was just, if I didn't go to college, I was already a failure. It already meant I was worth nothing. That was just how it was sold to me. And now I'm seeing my little brother, my brother-in-law, go through this same thing. And I'm like, no. Like, it's all social pressure to him. He's just like, I've got to go to college. And I'm trying to explain, no, this is an investment. Do not ruin your life. Do not go $60,000 in debt because somebody else is telling you you should, or you won't be successful. It's got nothing to do with the job market anymore. And it is because of the finances. Is because you can still subsidize and you can still issue $1 trillion in debt to shove all these kids into the university system, that it can be maintained. when people are actually having to pay the price, when the capital actually has to be pulled from somewhere, as opposed to just created out of thin air, you can't maintain those types of imbalances. You can't maintain $1 trillion in debt that won't be paid back, because you have to have real interest rates. You can't have that fake crap that the government just sets in price controls, or that the central bank just sets. Not possible with sound money. Bitcoin changes that dynamic. Same thing with healthcare, is the ability to do like phone call, like video sit downs with doctors, and be able to, you know, I can have a doctor's visit with somebody from the other side of the country. And when there's a great thread I read not too long ago about how it showed data on the number of physicians that were hired by hospitals and like in the healthcare profession, and the number of administrators. And it showed that in the late 1970s and early 1980s, the number of administrators per physician just started to skyrocket. And now it's like so many multiple. The chart looks ridiculous. Physicians have barely increased. They have like a modest increase over the same period of time. And administrators have grown like things like 2,500 or 3,000%. It just takes so many middle managers and administrators and politicians and just people to deal with all the bureaucracy now. Again, this is not sustainable in a sound money system. It is only because fractional reserve allows them to bloat the industries with unnecessary debts and charge ridiculous prices because insurance is always stuck between every consumer and the actual product. And all of this is going to be massively undermined by Bitcoin. And this is just the sound money side of it. This is just because you can't issue debt in Bitcoin backed by nothing. There's so many other things that are going to be disrupted because of what you can do with this technology. We're going to have our HTML moment. We are going to have the web as far as it is concerned with Bitcoin. And in my opinion, I think it's going to come as we really get out the development of the Lightning Network. Now, you may not know, most of my listeners know what the Lightning Network is. I've covered tons of stuff about it. If you want to go back in previous episodes, there's so much great stuff. I probably have 50 episodes about the Lightning Network. But the Lightning Network is a layer on top of Bitcoin. One of the fascinating things about Bitcoin is because you can program the contract. There's a script. The basic script of a Bitcoin transaction is I sign away my ownership and then I lock it up to you. So now you are the owner. But you can do all kinds of stuff with that contract. I can say you are going to be the owner in 50 minutes. You're going to be the owner in a week. I'm going to give you the coins for a week, and if you don't fulfill some half of some agreement and have, I don't know, eBay sign off on it, well, then the coins come back to me. You can write entire contracts. You can, and this can get complex. You can stack these things on top of each other and create contracts within contracts. And because of that, you can write this fascinating thing called a lightning channel, which essentially allows us to put money in a pool together. Think of it like a bar tab or something, where you have to have reserves, and then we can just update on the fly. We don't have to go back. We don't have to publish transactions on the Bitcoin blockchain, but we can just update this contract as we need to do payments back and forth. So if it's like Starbucks, well, you know, I can just go ahead and lock $200 up with Starbucks because I'm probably going to spend $200 in the next couple of months at Starbucks. I like to get a coffee every once in a while. It's like $5 a coffee. All right, so 40 trips to Starbucks. Yeah, I'll do that in like 4 months, 5 months. I can do all of those transactions in one by using a lightning channel. And then even more so, because we have these contracts, we set up these little liquidity channels between different people on this network. Well, maybe Starbucks has a channel with somebody else. Well, I can pay Starbucks and then Starbucks can pay them. We have the ability to create financial networks. And that was another major aha moment that I had when I was studying about Lightning and scripting on the Bitcoin network and stuff is that Bitcoin transactions are not going to be thought of as direct one-to-one Bitcoin transactions. They're going to be used to build financial networks where we can have thousands or millions of off-chain transactions that are settled contractually back to the Bitcoin network. So we extend the security and the independence of Bitcoin in order to build global decentralized financial networks. And this is going to be huge. It's going to be the thing that allows us to fund decentralized infrastructure. I think we're going to have another infrastructure inversion with nodes and devices that are dedicated to this these alternative networks and infrastructure that can be incentivized with micropayments. And here's a huge kicker. Is all the fintech that we've dealt with so far, the Venmo, the Cash App, all the little, like, I'm going to pay my buddy back $5 for the beer he got me, et cetera, et cetera. And these, you know, debit cards and stuff from non-bank bank accounts where you just have it with some other company, like Apple, you have your Apple card now, or your Amazon Prime credit card, that sort of thing. One thing that you cannot do on any of these is create a bot to pay with these services. Think about it. We're back in the AT&T day. Like, we're back with the permissioned network. I need to sign up with Cash App. I need to sign up with Venmo. It is not an open, available system. It is not one that I can build an app for. I have to call Cash App and be like, yo, I got a really great idea. Do you want to help funds and we can implement this on your wallet? And if they don't want to, not going to happen. Bitcoin is that inversion again. It is pushing the, is getting rid of the permission and just pushing the innovation to the edges. With Bitcoin and the Lightning Network, you can write an app that pays for infrastructure, that automatically pays to send a message, that automatically funds MeshNet in your area by offering the, you know, the same cost per packet, roughly, that maybe you even get with your ISP. And you can pay for a dedicated fast connection, or you can pay a tiny amount and have it not really care if it takes, you know, an hour to get to its destination. We can do this over radio. We can do this over satellite. We can fund an entirely different infrastructure, but it's only because, like, you can't fund micropayments on a mesh net using a program or using some actual bot or piece of software with Cash App. You can't do it with Venmo. It has to be permissionless, decentralized money. There has to be a protocol for payments that is independent of any single party. Otherwise, you got to call Cash App and be like, help me build this thing to fund a mesh net and make sure that we've vetted everybody. It's not permissionless. It's not permissionless. All the innovation is at the center. That means it won't move. Or at least it will move very, very slowly, and it will be capable of very few things. When you push that to the edges, when you have anyone, just like anyone can make a website, anyone can make an app on the internet, anyone can start a new service, anyone can create a new financial instrument, anyone can create a new financial contract, or a new way to gamble and play with little tricks. There's a fascinating little thing called the LNTX bot. It's a Lightning transaction bot in a Telegram group that we have. And I'm literally getting paid for my attention. I'm getting paid to receive direct messages as advertisements. And I can send out advertisements. So if I wanted to advertise my podcast, in fact, I'm probably going to. It's still a tiny, tiny little a subset of users. I think there's like 100 users on this bot who actually have accepted to receive ads. But one of the crazy things about it is that you decide what price it takes for someone to advertise to you. So if anybody advertises below the price which I set at, which is 15, I think it was like 15 sats per character or something like that. I can't remember exactly how the pricing works out. But if somebody pays below that price, well, then I don't see the ad. I don't have to worry about it. But I am getting paid for my attention. And this is just a bot. This is one of those crazy, because it's permissionless, we have, 50, 100 users on this thing, and you can satisfy. We have a payment, an advertising payment bot, which is solely in a couple of little Telegram groups, and is completely permissionless. Nobody knows what's going on. Like, you can't, there's no big company being asked permission. It's just a bot so that we can send information and messages back and forth, and we can attach payments to it, and it requires no one's permission, neither to innovate, design, create the software, implement, or use. That is an absolute breakthrough. That is a breakthrough in finance and money in the same way that the internet was a breakthrough in communication. It is that important. I think of it as like the seventh major disruption of the internet, but really it's the second major disruption. The internet was the decentralization and the access to an open, permissionless communications network, and Bitcoin is a decentralized, open, permissionless financial and value, a monetary network. And really, all those other six that I gave at the beginning, the e-commerce, the media disruption, the crowdsourcing disruption, all six of those others was just clever ways, different ways that you could use the decentralization of information. What six stages, seven stages of disruption will now come about because of Bitcoin? How will all six of those other stages change drastically? Because now we have a way to program monetary payments, like actual payments and contracts and reserves into these things. What happens to insurance? What happens to insurance when you can create a programmable way to store and manage the payout of funds through a decentralized reputation system without a manager, without a company, without an overhead? Insurance is the perfect candidate for a DAO, a decentralized autonomous organization that has very strict rules about how people get paid out from insurance and creates a joint pool like those like fraternities that happened before the age of like modern insurance. I think insurance is ripe for disruption because of decentralized money. There's so many things that are going to change, and I think to just think of it as this little payment system or this these new internet tokens really misses the point that this is an entirely new internet. This is an entirely new protocol with which we are building new protocols on top of it. Like TCP/IP birthed the internet, and we have now these interconnected networks all over the globe. And then we created HTTP, HTML, we've got FTP, we've got DNS servers, we've got certain routing protocols that we've built in, multiple routing protocols and fail safes, and we've got SSL, and we've got encryption and all of this stuff. We're doing the same thing. This is being built out right now. You can see it right now on Bitcoin. We've got Lightning Network, we've got state chains, we've got multiple other like little off-chain payment systems, like variations on the Lightning Network. We've got multiple clients that are working together. They're developing a standard. We've got multi-signature contracts. We've got non-custodial custodians and key management and restoration services. We've got decentralized mining pool, decentralized exchanges. Just so much. There's just an utter explosion. There are more people working on cryptographic systems. There are more people looking at and applying public and private key cryptography to new tools and new systems and creating new hardware in that actual industry and with that discipline. Today, we have more than ever before in the history of the discipline, ever before. And there is real money behind it. There's real money and security on the line. It's changing our security incentives to make things unbelievably strong and hard as a rock because there's real value on our computers now. I think it's going to change the massive insecurity and all the vulnerabilities on the internet. We're going to have to plug all these holes or we're not going to be able to use this thing properly. It's going to put everybody at risk. So it puts all the incentives in the right place, and it is a massive, massive game changer. And I think to call it digital money so deeply misses the point, or misses the mark on exactly how powerful this technology is, that it's incredibly hard to get across in a short amount of time. So hopefully in this rather long episode, I did somewhat of that. This is why I think Bitcoin is another major phase of disruption in the internet, and arguably one of the most important of everyone that has come so far, and that if we are not preparing for a future where Bitcoin is deeply integrated, we will end up being the grandmother that uses her phone, the same corded phone in the kitchen, not knowing that she is not talking to anything analog anymore. And we don't want to be that. We want to ride the wave. We want to be at the cusp of the future. We want to adopt the new technology and get the freedom and the privacy back as quickly as we can. So it's our obligation to figure it out. It's our obligation to explore it. If we want that future to happen, we have to be a part of it. We have to adopt it. We have to share it. We have to learn it, and we have to teach it. So that's why I'm here. And I hope that's why you're here too. This is The Crypto Economy with Guy Swan, and I think we are going to close this one here. Thank you guys so much for joining me. Don't forget, if you enjoyed this episode, and if you want to continue hearing all the coolest written works in audio in Bitcoin and the crypto economy, you want to keep learning about how groundbreaking this technology is and all the ways it's going to change our future, well, then do not forget to subscribe, and do not forget to share this out with everybody you know who would be interested in hearing about this crazy new technology and what it's going to mean for us, because that is what I do here at the crypto economy. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know, and I'm going to tell you all about it. Stay tuned, subscribe, share, and until next time, take it easy, guys.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.